This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
This season, a new hot deal has arrived at Metro. $25 a line for 4 lines with all the data you need and 4 free Samsung Galaxy A15 5G phones. Getting Metro's best deals is easy. No ID required, no activation fees. Get a new number or keep your own. It's up to you. That's 4 lines for $25 a line, plus 4 free phones. Visit a store or go online today. Only at Metro by T-Mobile.
When you join Metro Plus Tax, for limited time and subject to change. Max one offer per account.
I'm Rhett.
And I'm Link.
And we're the hosts of the podcast Ear Biscuits. We're just two lifelong friends who've been talking about life for a long time.
From being dads to businessmen to all the random things we experience, nothing is off limits.
And now we're talking to you. We're answering your questions, giving advice that you may or may not want to take, and listening to your hilarious stories.
So leave us a voicemail to be part of the show at
1-888-EARPOD1 on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
That is exactly what I needed to hear.
Thank God someone here knows what they're talking about.
That's us. That's right. Gotta love this American ride.
All right, you need to take the time and get the full picture.
Oh, yeah, it is the moment you have been waiting for.
Don't get me wrong. I love the ladies. I mean, they rev my engine, but they don't belong in the newsroom.
Andy's out. Ryan and Brad are in.
Goodness sake, kid. Keep your voice down. Your father's listening to the radio.
This is the Manny Fry Show.
You can't have nuclear weapons. And I think they're tapping us along because we're so used to dealing with stupid people in this country. And I had Iran perfect. You had no attacks. You would have never had October 7th in Israel, the attack by Hamas. Because Iran was broke. They were stone cold broke when I was president. And I don't want to do that. I want them to be a rich, great nation. The only thing is, one thing, simple. It's really simple. They can't have a nuclear weapon. And they got to go fast because they're fairly close to having one. And they're not going to have one. And if we have to do something very harsh, we'll do it. And I'm not doing it for us. I'm doing it for the world.
These are
radicalized people, and they cannot have a nuclear weapon.
We talk about the speed of the Trump administration this first 100 days, which we're still in barely. I don't think we got too much longer before we get outside that first 100. But it is amazing not just the speed with which they're working, it is the number of things they're working on.
Yeah.
General Keith Kellogg was on this show, and I think I pulled a clip of him saying that very thing for a promo.
Yeah.
That he said, look, it's that they're dealing with, I guess President Trump in particular, is dealing with so many different issues at once, domestically, internationally. He's not deciding, okay, I think I'm gonna try to solve the war in Ukraine. He's saying, I think I'm going to try to solve the war in Ukraine with Russia. I think I'm going to try to solve the war in the Middle East with Hamas and Israel. And I think we're also going to start pressuring Iran. And I think we're also going to start pressuring the Panama for the Panama Canal. And I think we're going to go after every nation in the entire world with tariffs.
Yeah. Like,
it is shocking. And really, that's the one thing I think right now that people and markets are nervous about.
Yeah.
Because it's human nature to react when there's big, sudden change. And usually that reaction is negative. It's, no. It always has been. And in fact, it's shown up in voting patterns. If you've ever noticed, guess what happened right after Barack Obama got into office, sweeping mandate, big right. win for Barack Obama over John McCain. He gets into office and he goes, wow, we've got, and they barely had it, a supermajority. Mm-hmm. If you call it, is it 60 is a supermajority or 66? I don't remember which.
It's a veto-proof.
It's a veto-proof, yeah, filibuster-proof majority. And so they had that in 2009. And they're like, gosh, this is a dream come true. We're going to go hope and change on everybody. And they immediately passed Obamacare, and the nation went, nope. We do not like all this change, even though we just voted for change.
The rise of the Tea Party.
The rise of the Tea Party. And guess what happened in Massachusetts? You had Kennedy die, the senator, mm-hmm. and they elected a Republican, Scott yeah. Brown, who ran on just ending Obamacare.
Yeah.
That's all he ran on. And Massachusetts said, yeah, we'll go for the Republican. Because people just don't like big, sudden change. The same thing happened in 2000, I hope I'm getting the right year here, 2022,
mm-hmm.
when Roe versus Wade was overturned. It was about 3 or 4 months before the midterms. President Biden, by 2022, was so far underwater that I'm not sure anybody's been more unpopular at that point in a presidency. The only one that was close would have been Donald Trump in term number one. But I think Biden was actually lower in approval rating mm-hmm. even than Trump at that time. And so it should have been this massive 2010-style rebuke of the Biden era. But people get nervous with change. And so the Roe versus Wade thing happened, and it was a big change for this country, or at least it was supposed to be. And so that saved them from having this massive red wave is probably what happened. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, you look back and you're talking, you started this off by talking about Obamacare and how Obamacare was passed and everybody freaked out about it. But now that nobody likes Obamacare, but nobody wants to vote against Obamacare anymore.
It's just sort of there now.
Because people are like, well, it's terrible, but I am afraid of the unknown. Like, what's the other side of this? And I know that, like, the criticism of the Republican Party is like, well, what's their answer to Obamacare? Make it go away and go back to what it was. And people are afraid of that because now they don't remember what it was before.
Yeah, it's just gotten more and more expensive.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, again, that's why it's still important. And I think it's important that the Trump administration is doing what they're doing. Go in there, make these big changes, get them codified into law so that whenever it comes time for Democrats, if they win, to change things, the people will be like, I don't like change. Don't change this.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why it's so important to point out the approval ratings. You know, this should be a moment in time where everybody in the country is going, this is too much change. This is too much happening at once. Everybody's getting nervous. But the approval rating for Trump is pretty consistent.
Yeah.
It may have dropped a point or two, but overall, it's pretty much the same as when he was elected. Now, we're still within the first 100 days, so that could change. But it's really amazing how fast and furious he has gone after all this stuff. No reference to Fast and Furious on purpose there. But it's really remarkable that people are still going, yes, this is what we voted for. Yes, this really is what we wanted to happen, was all this at once.
Right, and this all happening at once is adding to what the chaos that people are perceiving. They have trouble seeing that there's a plan. But that's just because there's so many things that are in the works that we don't have a resolved issue to, and then the opposition is just screaming, yelling, and pulling their hair out, saying, look, they're trying to do all these other things. Well, it's hard to argue against that if you don't see what the whole plan is. But yeah, just the mere fact that they're doing everything all at once muddies that water.
And this is what the market is seeing, too. This is part of what – it's not just, oh, my gosh, tariffs.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you were just, oh, my gosh, tariffs, you would have been watching this the whole time. In fact, there were a lot of people that were watching this the whole time. And so they're not freaking out because tariffs. They're freaking out because – ah,
yeah,
everything
change.
Yeah, there's so much happening. I mean, that part of that really is the human psyche. We just walked through a couple of great examples of when this has happened in recent American history. That, again, if you have Massachusetts that elects a Republican senator, it's not because they've become conservative,
right?
It's because big change scares people, and so we're right in the midst of this. We said we were going to talk to Jim Carafano this hour. I don't know whether we'll connect with him right now. We're trying, or that'll be later. But I had an article that I brought up, and we'll talk about the Iran stuff too, which we opened with here. I had an article that I brought just because it's something you don't see a lot of. And this is from the Telegraph in Britain. Now, the Telegraph, as far as I understand, this is an American newspaper, so I don't follow it quite as closely. But this isn't a right-leaning organization. Okay. I don't get the sense that they're super far left. Daily Mail's another one.
Yeah.
They're kind of tabloidy, and tabloids, oddly, will just do anything.
Yeah.
So they're not really right-leaning or left-leaning. They just grab stuff because it gets clicks. Telegraph isn't quite Daily Mail. They're a little bit more of a real news source. But they have that air, that kind of like British, you don't really know what the BBC is going after here kind of right. thing, where it's not American right, it's not American left. So I say that because this article really shocked me to see that the Telegraph was reporting on this. They follow a journalist in Sweden. And this is stuff that, like, for instance, the really genocide almost that's happening in South Africa right now was not something that people were talking about until just recently. But there have been racial motivated killings of white people in South Africa now for over a decade. And the government there continues to kind of turn a blind eye. It's like they want credit for saying, no, everybody's equal, but not really doing much about right. it. And so now that Elon Musk, he's from South Africa, he's obviously in a prominent position in America and in the government, now this is getting a lot more attention. This is a similar type of story. Not the same, but just a similar type of story of something that's happening in Sweden that isn't really getting a lot of attention. And so when you see it, you go, whoa, that's crazy, because yeah. I've always heard that Sweden has the highest standard of living in the world.
Oh,
and all these stats about, oh, yeah, you want the Swedish or the Norwegian lifestyle. Well,
that's what they say, but they're becoming less and less, what is the word, homogenous?
That's exactly what this article is talking about. So gang crime has gotten so out of control in Sweden. You're nodding like you've seen this.
I've
before.
Seen
Have
this.
You
yeah,
really?
Yeah, it's on the corners of the internet.
Yeah, it's
people
just kind of
complaining about it.
It's just kind of like out there, but nobody's really diving in.
Right.
And so when this article did so, I'm like, dang, this is crazy. Gang crime has become so bad in Sweden that this journalist, Diamant Salihu is his name, has had to do phone messages that are encoded to report on it because he's worried that the gangs are going to target him. Mm-hmm. At first glance, all of these things that the reporter from the article is talking about this other reporter, he says it looks like it's spam, but then he realizes, oh, this guy's texting me in code to make sure yeah. that people aren't picking up on what he's saying. There are murder gangs for hire now in Sweden, and it's becoming such a huge problem. And there's such large sums of money to be earned that they're realizing that the gangs themselves are not even necessarily the ones leading it. They're responding to it. So somebody is paying gangs to assassinate people in Sweden. And there's no real rhyme or reason. I don't know the politics of Sweden well enough to say, oh, this is the people that they're targeting. Mm-hmm. It's just out of control because it's gotten so bad that online now you can go see some of the same kind of code stuff that's written, and they're actually murder ads posted online by gang leaders offering bounties to anyone willing to carry out the hits. And I guess whoever's paying for this, including the gang leaders, are recruiting mostly children in Sweden. So you're talking about now, this isn't just a problem that we talk about like in third world countries where right. You have gangs that are just awful recruiting little kids. This is happening in Sweden because the money is so good. You're talking about close to six figures for one kill, that age doesn't matter, is the quote. Why many of Sweden's new contract killers aren't hardened hitmen, but children. Part of the problem, many say, is that Swedish law dictates anyone aged under 15 is too young to be prosecuted. Mm-hmm. You can't even prosecute them.
Yeah.
So it's like they get this free pass if you're 14 years old or under to just go commit murder. and you can't be prosecuted.
You murder somebody, you get six figures for the murder, and there's no negative consequences for you.
Unbelievable.
Legally speaking, that'd be
legal. Yeah, right. Not eternally. Quote here, we have so many child soldiers that nobody can count anymore, says this journalist, an investigative reporter for SVT, Sweden's answer to the BBC. There are kids as young as 13 that are being arrested. Now, here's they're acknowledging this problem, but they're not acknowledging where the problem is, how it's allowed to fester, because they say it's not necessarily Swedish kids that are doing this. It's immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
It's immigrants that are joining gangs and realizing, oh, I don't have to be poor anymore. I can just go commit murder and I'm off scot-free.
I'm set.
And really the big picture of this article is how the title of it is how Sweden's multicultural dream went fatally wrong. For this story, this journalist has pursued for the last decade one giant unsolved murder mystery. Why has Sweden, long the envy of the rest of Europe, and I would say world, for its peace and prosperity, just like we were saying, suddenly seeing so many gangland killings? Why, in a land that prides itself on welcoming migrants, are so many gang members from migrant communities? And is it Swedish society that is ultimately the culprit, or is it the migrant communities themselves? So they're walking right up to the doorstep and asking the question, but not quite answering the question. And here's the problem. Because we want to be so mindful and sensitive, mm-hmm. we won't address real problems anymore. To say that you can just import an entire culture of people and just say, you exist. The coexist thing, it just doesn't work. You either have to do one of two things. You have to bring this culture in and then you adapt to the culture, which in this case would be terrible because that culture is murderous. Or you have to bring them in and then they adapt to your culture. There are no other options. It has to be one of those two. And what we're doing in the West generally, although there's a lot more pushback in America, what we're doing in the West and Western Europe is they're importing entire cultures into their culture. And then they're pretending like you can just coexist. But ultimately what's happening is they are assimilating to the migrant culture instead of vice versa. And you're seeing a lot of weird consequences like this because of it, unfortunately. And it has nothing to do with race. It has everything to do with culture. You bring in a culture that believes in one thing versus a culture that believes in another, even if it's secular, and they just don't coexist. So it looks like we do have Jim Carafano on the phone. So let's take a short break, and we'll try to get back with Jim. We'll talk about where the world is concerning not just Ukraine, not just Russia, but also Iran, the Middle East. We'll catch up with Jim Carafano next.
Nerves and you rattle my brain. Too much love drives a man insane. You broke my will, but what a thrill. Goodness and gracious, great ball of fire.
This is the Annie Fry Show.
Honey, you came along.
I just wish we lived in a country where the media gave to one-tenth a damn as much about Americans who were murdered and brutalized and savagely killed, beaten to death, as they did about whether illegal aliens that we all agree are illegal aliens should get a million days in court and a million trials and a million this and a million that. There's 15 million illegal aliens that violently enter the country. If every one of them got the trial that you're asking for, it would take us centuries to remove them. Centuries. We'd be talking about this in 300-400 years. Their great-great-great-grandchildren would be the ones representing them in court. That's how long it would take. Illegal aliens who come to our country have to be removed, and they have to be removed quickly. That is an essential component of having something that we like to call a country.
And we like to call this the Manny Fry Show. Annie is out today. Ryan and Brad in studio. Jim Carafano on the phone. Jim, thanks for being here.
Okay, it takes two men to replace one Annie Fry. That sounds about right.
Well, you know, I mean, if you want to say it that way, that will end up being the promo. But let's say this, you know, Annie leaves and then we didn't even replace her. You know, it's really just us and we're already on the show. I like it to look at it that way.
Well, that's true, too.
At least I got that concession. Jim, we were talking.
You absolutely did. Yeah. Good.
Well, we were talking about immigration in the last segment and I figured we'd open on that with you. The border, you know, the Trump administration out there touting that the border is as secure as it's ever been. Is that actually the case?
No, it's a lie. It's actually more secure than it's ever been. I mean, Trump has done things that, even Trump never did before. You know, actually, for example, creating a buffer zone on, the Indian land, which was a super highway for the cartels to, bring stuff in. You know, before what would happen is, the cartels basically would walk into the Indian reservation territory because it was very poorly controlled. And then, but you had to leave the Indian reservation territory. So there were so many exit points off the reservation. And so the Border Patrol guys would hang around like buzzards at these exit points trying to snare these guys before they left. But taking this avenue away from the cartels is really huge. So I think between the enforcement and the stuff they've done at the border, this is unprecedented border security. Honestly, this is better than Pershing riding Chase and Pancho Villa in the Mexican War. This is the most secure this border's ever been.
Jim, is it both borders? Is it just Mexico? I mean, it seems like Canada is a much bigger border, harder to patrol.
It is, but it's a different set of problems and a different set of challenges. And you don't want or need to do the things on the Canadian border that you do on the southern border. A lot of the stuff on the Canadian border you're particularly worried about is transnational criminal activity. And that's really about going after the networks. You know, you've got the fentanyl factories and other things up north, and you need the Canadians to really help you out there. It's a tougher border to cross in many places too. It's not a forgiving, the terrain's not very forgiving, and so it's a different problem. But the mass migration problem is a southern border problem. And what's important about this, and what's so important about Donald Trump becoming president, is, you know, we always think of, oh, these people come from Latin America. Well, the reality is that the huge demographic bulge in Latin American population is actually on the decline. And the masses of people that we were starting to see at the border were not from Latin America. They were from Africa. They were from the Middle East. They were from Asia and China, because these are the places where the demographics are still climbing. And people were essentially signing up for a tourist agent, and you would book your illegal entry in the United States through places like Venezuela. And if these networks had, like the Darien Gap and everything, essentially had become cemented in concrete, which is where we were headed, we would well have been onto course within a decade or so, where the people who are legally in the United States would have been in the minority in this country. And what Trump did is he cracked those things before they essentially rooted in. And it is really an amazing accomplishment.
In February and March, probably the early part of March, we were talking a lot about Trump using the tariffs to get Mexico and Canada to respond specifically to immigration and fentanyl. We're not talking about that as much anymore. Is that because that worked?
I actually, when they write the history of this, I wonder if he will say, well, you know what? That worked pretty well. Let's see what we can do globally to twist people's arms, because it's very clear that the tariff battle has emerged into really an instrument to realign the global economic structure to compete with China. I think that's where we're headed. I think everybody, I think everybody's going to be better off when we do this, except China.
Everybody in the world, even the people that we're putting hard tariffs on?
Well, you know, because in the end, nobody really wants... First of all, it's not about the Chinese and the Iranians, because they're so sanctioned, there's almost no trade with those guys anyway. Mm-hmm. But in the rest of the world, nobody really wants a trade war with the United States. So I doubt we're going to go into this really escalatory tariff competition with anybody. And we might wind up with, okay, we can't cut a deal. And then what we'll probably settle for is just reciprocal tariffs. So you tariff our stuff, you know, tariff your stuff. Which I actually think is kind of what we do anyway in the world. So that's actually not remarkably new. But this really kind of forcing the world to make some hard thoughts and choices about doing business with the Chinese And I think the reality is look, we're seeing this. When you look at the scale of the investments that are moving to the United States, when you look at companies strategically repositioning stuff out of China, now, I think in fairness, we're all doing something we were starting to do anyway, which is recognizing the risks of doing business in China and being dependent on China. I remember a guy the other day says, this is stupid. You know, you should just buy. Why is America worried about this? Just buy stuff from the cheapest supplier. I said, well, if that was true, like during the Cold War, we would have bought cars from the Russians. I mean, that doesn't make any sense, does it? I mean, geopolitics matter. And so who you trade with, it has costs and risks that are just as significant as the price tag you see on the goods in the Walmart.
Jim, I'm glad you brought up China and this part of this, because we talk about the tariffs all the time. I mean, that's the top news story really just about every day right now. But we usually talk about it from the financial angle. You know, we're talking about what's this going to do to this industry and how is this country going to respond.
Right.
We don't talk about it from the national security standpoint, which very much is part of this conversation, especially with China. But I guess my question for you is, when I watch this and I think about, well, how's China going to respond? What I'm asking is not how are they going to respond financially. It's how are they going to respond psychologically? What are they going to try to do to us overall? Because they just don't want to lose power.
So typically what the Chinese, it's a great question, by the way, there's an old saying that the enemy gets a vote, and people think that, you know, you just impose your will on the other guy and he just accepts what you do. That is hardly ever the case. So the Chinese are very flexible and adaptive, and we see this all the time. Like, you heard about wolf warrior diplomacy, where they come in and threaten everybody. And then you hear about, they come in and they play like, oh, I'm just a nice guy. What do you, and, or they just bribe people and stuff. And so the Chinese will try different ways to find the gaps and seams and weaknesses that they can exploit if what they're doing isn't working. One is they're not going to stop trying because they can't, right? They set up a system, and like the mafia, they just have to perpetuate that system. They have less resources to do this with because their economy is not growing at the robust rate it is. And it is still highly dependent on trade with the United States. 40% of their economy is trade. If you take the U.S. off the table as a trading partner, the rest of the world cannot absorb that trade. That is a death knell for the economy. So they've got some limitations, and the Chinese still believe that the idea is, the ancient idea is you want to win without fighting. The last thing you want to do is waste your power beating your head against an enemy. So you really don't want to invade Taiwan if you don't have to. You really don't want to have a war with the United States if you don't have to. And so the answer is you look for every other kind of weakness and stuff you can exploit, which is what, you know, why they don't want to let go of things like TikTok, why they try to bribe people right and left, why they try to take over international organizations and use that to express their will. So the Chinese are not going to stop being our enemy if Trump, you know, hits a double in the trade war. And that's, if we prepare for that, hardly ever, you know, in the movies, you win a war and the movie's over. You read a book, the war is at the end of the chapter. In real life, you know, those things hardly ever stop. I mean, enemies are like the Terminator. I mean, if they can still survive and fight, they're going to try to find ways to do that.
Jim Carafano is senior counselor to the president and E.W. Richardson Fellow for International Engagement at the Heritage Foundation. Drawing from your expertise on these things, Jim, what does an end to this look like? I mean, you just kind of answered that and saying, well, maybe there's not a just hard end to the chapter and then we move on. But, you know, at what point do you go, okay, this was successful for the U.S. or, hey, China actually did kind of come to the table here. I mean, what happens next, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Well, I mean, one is you have a diminished China, which will probably reset. And that could be a change in leadership with a younger, more aggressive leadership. It could implode and fall apart. It could redirect its efforts elsewhere. So, for example, if you have a weakened China and a weakened Russia, one avenue is just China goes after Russia. Lots of land, lots of resources, a very weak enemy. you know, the United States isn't going to fight to defend Russia from China. So, you know, and the other, you know, the enemy gets a choice or a vote. And so the other thing about autocratic regimes is you can never really tell how vulnerable they are. And this is why they often get or are so obsessive about trying to control, because they don't know when they're really at risk of losing control. And the Chinese system could collapse. I don't think you can count on that. So what you do when you're a strategist is a lot of people want to plan for the end state they want, or the one they would like, or the one they expect. Which the best strategies are ones that it doesn't matter what the outcome is, you're still ahead of the game. And that's what I think Trump is fundamentally setting us up for. Peace through strength, which means you can defend yourself, which, by the way, absolutely, totally, 100% in every theater in the Middle East and Europe, in Indo-Pacific, requires America to have strong friends and allies, which is why Trump beats the hell out of our allies to do more. And a strong, robust economy and a vibrant democracy that people have trust and confidence in, that is like the best situation to be in to face no matter what the outcome that the enemy throws at you.
Jim, you mentioned Russia. I'm kind of following your lead here. You mentioned Russia being in a weakened state now. I've never really heard anybody say what you just said, that, yeah, China might even, you know, go to flex their muscles over there a little bit. But right now, you know, we're talking about trying to end this war in Ukraine. They're dragging their feet, but they're in this weakened state. I mean, how much longer can they go?
So I posit three scenarios. One is, it's in the Russians' nature when they negotiate to want something for nothing and to push to get as much as they can before they do a deal. So Putin just may realize that tomorrow that, okay, this is all I can get and I'm going to cut a deal, because they need a strategic pause as much as the Ukrainians. Neither one of them can really win this war. So that's one thing. And I don't think we should be surprised at that Putin just stands up and says, okay, you can have a deal. Forget what I said, mobilizing 160,000 people. Forget it. We're just doing a deal. But you can't count on that. So the other thing is, Putin says, oh, you know what? I'm going to fight for another year, because as weakened as they are, they can fight for another year. And then what does Trump do? One is he just says, oh, well, screw you guys. I'm just going to walk away. Right? I don't have anything to do with it. I think that's unlikely, because if things go south in Europe, Trump will be blamed on that. You know, he can't afford a huge foreign policy reversal right now as he's trying to drive the economy and everything else. The other thing is we just continue to support the Ukraine, which is becoming less and less of a lift every day. You know, 3 years ago, they had $1 billion defense industry. Today, they have a $15 billion defense industry. The Europeans every day, because Trump is actually, they think they're scared Trump's going to run away, they keep actually supporting Ukraine more. So the burden of supporting Ukraine is shifting more and more to the Europeans. The Ukrainians have more and more figured out how to stay in the fight. So honestly, it's easier and easier for Trump to support Ukraine. And I think we have to parse his disdain for Zelensky, which is palatable. I mean, the U.S. has done everything for this, and Zelensky kind of whines like a spoiled child, and he keeps essentially attacking Donald Trump, who's actually the leader you need to make your country survive. I think I'd be annoyed if I was President Trump. But I don't think Trump's going to throw Ukraine overboard just because he thinks their leader's a bozo. Nor do I think we're going to replace them, because, you know, we don't do regime change. But continuing to support Ukraine is something that's in the cards. And you got to think Putin's got to know that. He does not have a strong hand. You know, when Trump said to Zelensky, you don't have the cards here, he was right. But he's also told that to Putin, you don't have the cards to play. The only guy that really has cards on the table is Donald Trump.
And it's these autocratic regimes, it's like you said, it's like all they're interested in is saving face. If they can just say they won. And Trump knows this. He's trying to figure out, well, how do I allow you to say that you won while also getting nothing? Am I wrong there?
Well, but in a sense, because in an autocratic regime, you can always say you won. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, I guess
right? So what you never do is like, oh, let me let you save face, right? Because you don't need that. You're going to save face anyway. You're just going to tell people you won. So it doesn't matter. So you should, the last thing you should ever do is give somebody like Putin something for nothing, because that just makes them greedy and it makes them think you're weak and they can get more. So being nice to these guys, it doesn't do you anything. And the problem is all we hear about is these stupid articles, and we get snippets of this, and then Trump says something. And you know what it reminds me of is like somebody that sits down in a ball game, and after the first pitch says, okay, who's going to win? It's a negotiation. We don't know what's going on behind doors. We don't know everything that Trump in Trump's strategy. We don't know how this is going to turn out. And so these, you know, armchair strategists and that are just telling you, oh, this is good, this is bad, this is terrible, they don't know. Because they're not, you know, the game is not over yet. When the game is over, then we can all say, oh, geez, that was good or bad or whatever. But saying that now is kind of stupid.
Jim, let me ask you one final question here, kind of tie the whole thing in a bow, because China has announced that they're gonna start stopping their shipments of rare earth minerals to the United States. There's been big NVIDIA announcement that they're going to start building $500 billion worth of supercomputers all here in Texas, apparently. So that's good news. But if we don't have the rare earth, you know, that kind of affects that too. But then Trump's trying to do a deal for rare earth minerals with Ukraine. Is that what's really keeping us involved there? Or, I mean, that's kind of a simplistic question, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's a good idea, because if the United States is engaged in Ukraine, they don't need security guarantees. I mean, the Russians aren't going to march in and attack a country where Americans are there. But rare earths are not rare, and critical minerals are all over the world. It's you have to mine them, and more importantly, you have to have the reprocessing capability. The Chinese have tied up like 90% of the world's reprocessing capability. And what they do is anytime anybody wants to build a mine or build a processor, the Chinese just cut the price of the commodity, and it makes it financially undoable. What the Chinese are doing, which is really stupid, what they're doing by essentially threatening to cut everybody off is they're forcing you to do, or they're telling you to do what you really should do, which is you cannot trust having these critical supplies from the Chinese. So you have to bite the bullet and make the investments and build your reprocessors and develop your mining resources. And then the Chinese have nothing. You know, never take a hostage you aren't willing to shoot. Threatening the United States with cutting off critical minerals on world's earth, knowing that the United States can actually find other ways to do that, that's just stupid. What's the word in Chinese for stupid? Call me later and let me know.
I don't speak Mandarin. I don't know. Jim Carafano, man, appreciate the insight. It is just great to talk to you. It's never a dull moment. This is a moment in time, Jim, I don't know if you agree, that I keep thinking people are going to look back on this and say, that was a new era. Everything changed in that time.
Yeah, I live for this stuff, man. Yeah. If everything was just like, oh, nobody cares, I would have nothing to do.
Right. Well, there's a personal vested interest there.
Yeah. I mean, we just need more forest fires and a couple of plagues, and then I'd be really happy.
Oh my gosh. Don't say that. Jim Carafano. Always appreciate your expertise on everything. I know I can just throw anything at you and you're like, oh, well, here's how that works. So thank you.
Thanks for having me. Say hi to Annie when she gets back.
All right, I will. Bye. That'll be tomorrow. And so thanks for tuning in to the Manny Fry Show. As Jim just said, Annie will be back tomorrow. Stick around. Something we were talking about, at the end of last hour? The Ark of the Covenant?
Yeah, we were talking the Ark of Covenant and psychics and clairvoyance. And
We got at least one caller who wants to comment on that. And so I don't know what we're going to be talking about next.
Annie's out. Ryan and Brad are in. This is the Manny Fry Show.
I did not pick this music, I tell you that right now.
We blame it on Ethan.
Yeah, thank you. There's an active shooter situation reported. We don't know what that means. It's in Dallas. There's the helicopter shots. They're watching kids being evacuated. We'll report on that if we find out anything else. But we'll be watching it, just so let you know. If you want to fight, I'll tell you where to come fight in the YouTube live chat. Because we'll talk about things on the show like we're just talking about in this hour with Jim Carafano. And then you guys just go off on something And the fun part is Brad really loves participating in
those.
I
do.
And jumps in there, and it's just, I'm sort of watching this while I'm talking to Jim Carafano going, what are you guys doing? Well, if you want to be a part of the discussion.
We're having an in-depth discussion on trade and China and who has the leverage in that situation.
Did you win?
I always win.
Well, at the end of last hour, Brad also did Wiggins America and was talking about this report from the CIA that was declassified, that the CIA in the 1980s, 1988, they were using psychics to seek out the Ark of the Covenant, and now we know about this. And they said in the reports, I guess, that they found the Ark, but then they never did anything about it, so they didn't ever actually go find the Ark.
So we don't know if they actually found it.
So in light of that, I want to thank Michael, because he's been a trooper. He called in right at the end of that segment and has been hanging on the line. Kind of, we waited. We told him, hey, you know, we gotta do an interview here, but if you want to call back, that'd be great. So in light of that discussion, Michael, what is on your mind, man?
Yeah, I was listening to your last segment. Let me give you a little brief history of me. My wife, I married a psychic. When I met her, I was out for the evening.
You married a psychic, or your wife married a psychic?
No, I married her.
Okay.
So I'm out for the evening. I'm telling you a little history so you trust who I am.
Okay. And we only got a couple minutes, so.
Okay. She buys me a beer. I go up and I thank her, and I got to talking to her. I says, what do you do for a living? She says, I work for Creator. I says, well, you're not a nun. She says, I'm a psychic. I never even gave psychic a thought in my whole life. Now I marry her about a year after that. Then she tells me the night we were out, I had taken my ex-wife and her new boyfriend out for the evening because she got a divorce from her second husband. And the psychic, my wife, said, you know, I was weirded because I felt a stronger connection between you and the woman across the table from you, which had a man's arm around her. And I said, that was my ex-wife. To start off with that is, she is a spiritual advisor. They are not, spirituality and religion are separate. They do coincide together. There are carnival psychics, fake psychics, wannabe psychics, and then there's gifted psychics that have the gifts from God. Now, you can believe this or not. I don't care. Now, what I have found out in the past is she doesn't read the future. She sits with you and she sees who you are and feels your energy at the present moment, and she guides you through your next chapter. She'll give you tools and homework. And then when you come back to her, she'll know if you've done that homework. So if you believe in disciples walking the earth, why can't a psychic be a disciple in a sense?
So, Michael, you're saying that she's legit, that she's really got a gift here. She's not a carnival psychic, right?
Absolutely. And I could tell you stories that would raise the hair on the back of your neck.
Yeah, I believe you. But let me ask you this. What do you and what does she say that power comes from? Because you said that this could be a gift from God. So are you saying that she's got this gift from God?
No. Basically, here's what I think. Her mother died when she was 3. Her father was in prison most of her life. She lived on the streets and she slept in graveyards because nobody would go there in the middle of the night. So she learned, she had nobody to tell her that the stove was hot. So she had to learn this herself. She washed herself in a Vickers gas station down in South County to go take herself to school. So she opened up that left part of her brain because she had no options. Now, is that a gift from God? I believe so. She was given that extra perception that we all have but don't know how to use.
So you're saying this is something that everybody's born with. She's just been able to kind of sharpen it up, but all of us have this thing that we could use.
That is exactly what she says. We all are built in God's image. And her best friend is God. Trust me, her best friend is God.
Boy, Michael, I would have so many more questions for you. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but I find this topic very, very fascinating. So thank you for hanging on, even though we got to let go. Yeah.
Give me a call.
All right. Thanks, Michael. Gosh, it's just an interesting topic. I would love to delve into it more, and everybody has thoughts. Actually, lots of people calling in, so sorry that we're out of time. We are going to come back in the 2 o'clock hour and have a little fun with Trisha in studio. Stick around.